a lot of people will tell you within the community of adoptees, you know, our life doesn't start the day we were adopted. There's this whole other time and space and family that existed prior.
Society in general, they don't really understand the implications of adoption. They just feel, well, you were adopted, problem solved.
I knew I couldn't stay where I was or keep living with that grief. So moving through it was the only option.
I know in African culture, that's extremely important that you're able to put yourself into, they call it the flow of time. And it feels like that my lineage has been cut with my adoption.
There's such value in being in community among other adoptees, and it was validating for me. So that really helped for me to get connected, and then seems as if the world just opened up.
If I'm the secret that everybody has held for 37 years, you know, who can I talk to? And finally, it just hit me. I have a choice here. You're affected from the moment it happens. You're impacted. But I needed to know that I was going to be able to come to an understanding and a reconciliation.
It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. A part of my identity is being an adoptee, being separated at birth from my original family and placed into foster care for 2 years has significantly impacted how I see my place in the world. You may have wondered what reunion looks like from an adoptee's point of view, or be embarking upon taking that journey yourself to search for your first family, or simply want confirmation that you are not alone in your experience. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? My next guest holds a master's degree in interfaith pastoral counseling, where she wrote her thesis on openness in adoption as an opportunity for spiritual growth. It was during this time in 2001 that she initiated her reunion with her birth mother and later with her birth father. Her name is Jennifer Poole. In this episode, she shares a part of the journey of searching for her birth first mother and the profound mirroring that they both experienced in real time. Jennifer's passion for supporting families led her to becoming certified in hand-in-hand parenting, redirecting children's behavior, the Enneagram, and whole person design life coaching. Drawing from a large toolbox, which includes continuing education in mindfulness, high conflict diversion, ADHD, ACES, attachment theory, and trauma-informed care. She provides counseling and coaching to help families move from conflict to the connection they seek. She also works with Adoption Mosaic as a co-teacher and parenting consultant. As their adoptee outreach coordinator, Jennifer interviews adoptees to help find panelists for their We the Experts series. Allow me to introduce to you someone who did the deep dive of adoptee consciousness in her early adult years that led to the discovery of what tools were going to be of benefit to her for an authentic and holistic life. From her, I derive inspiration, enjoyment, and a tenacity to investigate all the possible modalities available to all of us for the purpose of helping everyone. Well, hello, Jennifer. My name's Sake. I'm so happy for you to join me for Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. How are you doing in Portland?
I'm great. The sun's been out the last few days, so everyone's mood is elevated when the sun comes out in Portland. It's been really beautiful spring.
Does it usually rain there?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty rainy. And this time of year, usually, you know, we have some breaks, sun breaks, but there's usually more rain. We've had a pretty sunny spring. Because it's so rainy and everybody's trapped inside, when the sun comes out, it's like everybody outside, hello, beautiful day.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's nice.
I know. I've been to Seattle, so I'm guessing the weather's similar. And yeah. I was there for a weekend, and it was lovely. I mean, just beautiful. And everybody that I came in contact with said, you picked the perfect weekend to be here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of, we kind of joke around that people will come up to visit Portland in the summer and be like, this place is beautiful and amazing. And they don't realize that it's like 6 months of rain pays for that beautiful, amazing summer.
Right. But that makes for a beautiful greenery, I bet.
It does, yeah. No, yeah. It's a very beautiful place to live. Just very gray.
I met you through Adoption Mosaic. Astrid Castro introduced us, and I know you're very active with that group. Maybe we'll start there. You are the Adoptee Outreach Coordinator.
Yeah, which is kind of a fancier name than for what I do. What I actually do is I interview people for our We the Experts panel. And so We the Experts is a monthly panel that we do that highlights and uplifts the voices of adoptees on different issues that are important to us. And the issues can be anything like the last one we just did was LGBTQ adoptees and reunion, you know, talking about anxiety about having a reunion with family, especially in other countries that might be more homophobic cultures. You know, we had adoptees who searched and then found that their birth parents had already passed. We have one coming up who are experiencing infertility. So it's just different issues in the adoption world and how they affect adoptees, in part because, as you know, the script has been written by adoption agencies and by adoptive parents, and it leaves out the trauma that's inherent in adoption. And so not that we want to focus on the negative, but that we want to bring like the reality and the truth to the experience of being adoption to the world so that people can make more ethical, informed decisions around adoption.
Oh, also, I love that. Yeah.
I mean, the other part too is we want to create community, and part of that is adoptees listening to each other and stories and knowing that we're not alone. My role as the adoptee coordinator is when people find our website or find us on social media, they fill out a form if they're interested in being on We the Experts panel, and then I interview them. And I think I interviewed you a couple of years ago, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been on there twice. I was an alternate the first time, and recently, like the end of 2023, I joined the panel again. It was really a wonderful experience and such a valuable resource in our community.
Yeah, I feel grateful to be a part of it. And the best part is I get to, you know, we can't put everyone on a panel. We'd love to, but there's just more interest than panels. And we try and keep it to four people per panel plus an alternate. But I get to listen to all everybody's stories and connect with adoptees. And I feel really fortunate. I do that on a volunteer basis and I enjoy it. It's really, I don't know, it's meaningful to me. I like connecting with adoptees and hearing their stories. And what I've listened for is, you know, if there's a number of different places where we might be able to put them on a panel, because we try and, you know, ideally we'd like to get everyone on, but it's just not possible. So the more different topics I can find for one person, the more chance I have of being able to maybe find a panel for them.
I appreciate you sharing that, because somebody listening might be wondering how that works. So good. That's good to know. And so I'm also recently familiar with Better Together with Adoption Mosaic. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Better Together is also one of my favorite things. I mean, actually I like so many things. This is my favorite. Yeah. So back during the pandemic, before the pandemic, I was co-teaching with Astrid a children's class. It was for adoptees that were, most of them were under age 8. And we did like a play group and we'd introduce, you know, adoption language and topics and do crafts and things to just normalize adoption for kids and then give them something to go home and talk to their parents and encourage dialogue with their parents. And when everything shut down for the pandemic, we took it online and we taught the parents how to do these activities with their kids. And then as we did that and we did other classes that were online, we found that the parents wanted to stay in contact. So we created Better Together, which started off kind of in this time of crisis when everything shut down, that the murder of George Floyd had happened. There was a lot of chaos and, you know, everybody was just needing some support. So we had these, you know, adoptive parents that were doing the work that wanted to stay connected. And then we had well-processed adoptees who, you know, most of us were adoptee professionals. And we started meeting once a week to support each other through this time. And it just kind of evolved into this support group that has just been lovely. Originally, it was a kind of adoptees supporting adoptive parents. They'd have an issue and then they bring it to us and they'd get a lot of different feedback, which is what I love about Better Together, because not all adoptions are the same. So it's a reminder every week when, you know, somebody has an issue, and then you get like three or four different points of view from different adoptees, which is great. And then the parents take that all in and kind of see, okay, what applies to my child and our situation. And then through doing that, we found that the adult adoptees, that it was so healing for us to be working with these parents who genuinely were doing the work, because, you know, for some of us, that was not our experience growing up. As that happened, more adoptees became interested and it's evolved. And now, you know, to be a part of Better Together, if you're an adoptive parent, you need to have gone through one of our courses and then you qualify to be on it. And if you're an adoptee, it's usually the way, if you've either co-taught with Astrid or if you come and you're a speaker, which I think that's how you started, you came and give a talk, because on the last Thursday of every month, we have a guest speaker that's an adoptee professional come give a talk on their experience. And then we usually invite them if they want to stay. It's a commitment because we're building community, that they want to show up consistently. And we've had quite a few people decide to do that. And it's just really evolved into this very supportive, nurturing environment. At least that's the Thursday group that I'm in, is the one that came out of the pandemic. We just opened up a new one on Monday evenings, and that's starting its own kind of vibe and culture of its own. I'm not in that one, so I can't speak to it as much. Yeah, I really value Thursday. I think Sujata is one of the adoptive mothers. It's also a co-trainer. She called it her church, like the Thursday, because we really delve into like deep emotional topics and support each other and, you know, just how we go through life and the challenges that arise and that are specific to adoption.
Sure. Yes. I became familiar with it back in March when Astrid invited me to be a speaker on that Thursday. And I felt like I was late to the party. It was so enjoyable. I appreciated the fact that all members of the Constellation were there. There were quite a few adoptive parents, and they just seemed ready to learn. They seemed very attentive to what I was saying as an adopted person. I think that that's so important. When I see adoptive parents, what I consider doing the work, I think about the adoptee in their life receiving the benefit.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why we do the work we do. I mean, for me, I can say that is why I do the work that I do. And I know that that's true for a lot of the people that I work with.
Yeah, and then the breakout at the end, towards the end, was really nice too. The check-in with just the adoptee group. I enjoyed that. So I've had an opportunity to attend the Thursdays twice. So I look forward to being there on Thursdays.
Nice. Yeah, I'm glad you joined. It's going to be really nice having you there. We have one birth mother, and if there's any part of the Constellation that's missing, I think we'd like to have more birth mothers, because that's a voice that has been most marginalized. You know, I think maybe it's harder too, because there is such a high level of trauma, and that the birth mother that's in our group is also an adoptee. She's a really important part of our group too, because she gets to add that other piece that isn't always mentioned.
Yes. Yeah, it was really good to meet her, and I'm hoping she'll be a guest on here soon. She's interested in that, and I am thrilled about that. So,
oh, good. Yay. Yeah.
Well, yay. I'm looking at your website with Adoption Mosaic, and it says you were adopted as an infant in a closed system, in a closed adoption, which I can totally relate to that. And you hold a master's degree in interfaith pastoral counseling. You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I was raised in a very Catholic family. I had questions about the dogma at an early age. I mean, I really embraced it, you know, as a child. God is love, you know, all that. But by sixth grade, when they just talked about God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son, and then, oh, just kidding, like at the last minute. That was horrifying for me. Like, I just was like, wait, I thought you said God was loving. Like, why would he ask a parent to like kill their child? Like, it activated all these questions and like things I wasn't sure about with the dogma. And by the time eighth grade, when we were planning, you know, confirmation, I chose the patron saint of Saint Anthony. Antoinette was the name I took because he was the patron saint of lost souls. Because I felt very confused. And I also, as an adoptee, I understood that like, if I was adopted into another family, I would believe what they taught me. And so that also led to me being very much of a questioner. Like I had trouble with the whole concept of hell and things like that. So by the time I was 18, I had a Jewish boyfriend. My mom's father was Jewish. He married my grandmother and committed to raise the kids Catholic, but never converted. And the priest was giving a talk on heaven and hell. And, you know, that the people who didn't believe what we believed were, you know, sad to say, going to hell. And I just walked out crying. I was like, nope, that's not for me. I don't believe that. And my mom was very upset because I was like, I'm not going back. But I still had this deep kind of spiritual longing. By the time I started my master's program, I had kind of like pulled away from religion, but wanted to reincorporate. I had this strong connection to the teachings that I grew up with around Jesus and love and being of service, the Beatitudes. And so this program offered like, what's a healthy belief system versus an unhealthy belief system? And it was interfaith. There was a lot of interfaith dialogue and how can we create more peace in the world and less division and more peace within ourselves. And so that was all very appealing to me. So I decided I was interested in counseling. So this was like a way that I could explore both of those things that I was interested in. When I got to the program, the very first day, they were like talking about how people that are drawn to this field are tend to be wounded healers. And because of that, there's a high burnout rate because people go into healing professions really wanting to heal themselves and don't realize it. And then they burn out. And so they said, you know, we'd like you to write all your papers on your own personal angst. And for your first paper, we'd like you to write it on your family heritage. We'd like you to entitle it Heritage and tell us about your family and your family lineage, which of course as an adoptee activated all my personal angst because I was like, oh, which one, the family that I grew up in or the family that I don't get to know about?
Wow.
So what started off as I thought I was going to be going into a counseling program and exploring world religions also ended up becoming like a 3-year deep dive into adoption and my own kind of adoption issues. And during that time was also when I decided to do a search and find my birth mother. And I ended up writing my thesis, which was called Openness and Adoption as an Opportunity for Spiritual Growth. And part of that was because I felt like part of what I explored in my thesis was that how when you read things like Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, or different spiritual authors, they talk about this innate longing that humans have to create a sense of meaning or to understand their place in the world. And I feel like as an adoptee, sometimes that can be like stunted or shown, it shows up differently because we may feel that emptiness or that something's missing, but we attribute it just to our adoption. You know, like I have this emptiness because I don't know all of myself, which is true. And then after I met my birth mother, there was kind of like this high and this peaceful feeling. But then I kind of settled back into, and there was still that same spiritual longing. It wasn't completely healed just by knowing my birth family, right? So that there's a different topics that I explored, but one was finding the piece that was missing in my adoption allowed me to go deeper in my spiritual search. But also there's another piece that I talk about, which is in the closed system, it creates all this shame and secrecy, and the church would basically shame mothers into giving their children to parents who were doing things like the correct way, which I think caused more trauma and harm than help. And I felt like they should be supporting mothers. So I talk about how, you know, if we're in a truly spirit, that spiritual growth comes from being honest and being understanding and compassionate and supporting people when they're in crisis. And so in my young and still evolving view on what openness, how it, openness and adoption can be an opportunity for spiritual growth, I wrote about how the opportunity to experience all those things that are spiritual concepts that I just said, they're available to you in open adoption, because you have to face things and you have to access compassion. You have to access understanding. You come to choose forgiveness. And I don't mean in the spiritual bypassing way, which is, you know, a lot of adoptees have a reaction to the word forgiveness because they're being told to forgive before they're even allowed to process like the pain and the trauma, which is not helpful. But if you are facing something head on by admitting that it was painful, by looking at what's happened and being honest about it, then that gives you the opportunity to process it and come to a place where you choose forgiveness on your own, not because somebody else is telling you to, because they have an agenda for you to behave in a way that's easier for them. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. And I know I wanted to kind of go back a little bit, because when you said a 3-year deep dive led you into searching for your mm-hmm. biological mother. Yeah, like that's a nice period of time, I would say, to really really wrap your mind around, as an adoptee, I'm going to say adoptee consciousness must have took place during those 3 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was my coming out of the fog period. I read my first adoption books at that time. Didn't know I needed to read them up until that. I knew there were issues and I was in therapy, but adoption didn't come up. The first book I read was Primal Wound, and that one just hit like a ton of bricks. And then I read Betty Jean Lifton's Journey of the Adopted Self, and I just remember having to put it down and just crying so much as I read it. After the first year of my program was when I decided to search for my birth mother. I also, that was the same year that I was engaged, and I found my birth mother right before I got married and then had a baby. So I had all these things going on at the same time, and it was beautiful, stressful. There was a lot of growth during that time. There was also a lot of pain. There were things in my marriage that were not great. And that was also part of when I started therapy back when I was actually before, is I, the first time I kind of realized maybe this good adoptee role that I'm playing isn't real. It started coming out in my intimate relationships. And that's when I kind of realized I had these people-pleasing tendencies. And when you do that, like, you're not showing up authentically, which I would have thought I was showing up authentically. I didn't even realize it was so subconscious, just my desire to avoid conflict and please. And making connections with adoption and how that affected my relationship, that was all unraveling as I was in that master's program, which I'm so grateful for, because I needed to unpack all that before I entered this kind of work. And Adoption Mosaic was not created at this point. She was working for Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center, and we got paired together to do a research project for open adoption and family services. We just connected, became great friends. We both were pregnant at the same time. Our daughters are a month apart. And I learned a lot more about the transracial adoption experience. I knew nothing about that until I met Astrid. And then that's been something I'm still learning about every day from the adoptees of color that have had experiences that were in some ways similar, in some ways very different than mine.
Yeah, I can relate to that too. It wouldn't be until I got better connected to the adoption community that I really learned about transracial, interracial adoptees and their experience, which, yes, very different from mine.
So you're a same race adoptee, right?
Right. I'm same race. And I'm often mistaken for being a transracial adoptee because I think that, and I've said this plenty of times publicly, I don't think same race Black domestic adoptees are as visible as interracial and transracial adoptees.
Right.
Yeah. I would like to talk a little bit about what it was like for you, your family environment growing up in California, San Pedro.
Yeah. So I love San Pedro. Like, it's a really tight knit community. It's a community of what I would call old country values. I kind of joke around and tell people, if you've ever seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding, that is very much what San Pedro was like when I was growing up. There are Greeks there, but my family was Croatian and Italian, meaning my father was Croatian and most of his brothers and sisters married Italians. And so that was what the cultural meals and environment was like that I grew up in. My mom was not Italian. Her mom was Irish Catholic and her dad was Jewish. But I grew up with a lot of cousins. All my dad's siblings were walking distance from our house. I saw them every, birthday, holiday. It was, very close community. What I didn't realize until I was older and found out was that my dad's parents were against the adoption. They wanted their kids to be Croatian. And my sister had told me a story about how when I was six, my nanny, who's my dad's mother, had all the cousins were there. And she was talking about, when I die, you can have this and you can have this and you can have this. And my older sister, who is my parents' biological child, noticed that she didn't mention me. And she said, well, what about Jenny? And my nanny said, well, Jenny's not a real Svetanich. So, like, she gets nothing, right?
Terrible.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't have a memory of that, but what I do remember is that I thought I had a mean grandma and a nice grandma, and she was the mean grandma. And then as I got older, I didn't understand why I thought she was mean until Laura told me that story, and I was like, oh, that would absolutely make sense about why I thought she was mean. And then my mom said, yeah, after your sister told me about that, you were never allowed to be at Nanny's house without me present, which I didn't realize, right, that that was going on. And I was kind of oblivious. Like, I felt like my family really embraced me. I got along with my cousins really well. My aunts and uncles, I adored them. But it wasn't until I was like in my 20s, I was having an argument with my uncle because he was saying some things that I frankly found rather racist and was challenging him on them. And he said, well, your opinion doesn't matter anyway, because you're not a real Svetanich. And I was like, I looked at him and I'm like, well, Barbara John, I've never thought of you as anything other than my uncle. And he's like, well, of course you wouldn't. You wouldn't know the difference. And yeah, I kept my composure, and then I got up and walked into the other room and just was bawling, and my mom found me, and she's like, I told her what happened, and she's like, oh, he's just a mean, nasty man. He, everybody fights with it. Like, don't worry about him, right? But it was the first time I realized that the experience that I was having up my family was based on what my mom had told me growing up, but it may not be actually how my family experienced me.
Oh my goodness. I am so glad. No, I am so glad you shared this. Because I'm kind of having a reaction over here to just what you said. I think that that may have been my experience as well. I think family members who are biologically related and they know of family members who are adopted, they do see a difference. They do feel a difference whether they vocalize it or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have like a cousin that I'm particularly close to and have talked to her. She's my sister's age. She's a little bit older than me. And we've talked now as adults about it. And her brother ended up adopting. And she's like, yeah, you know, I got to admit, I noticed my mom does treat, you know, their daughter a little bit differently than the other ones. Yeah, I was oblivious to that as a child. But as I got older, the other thing that was kind of waking me up was, so my mom, who was very Catholic, she, most of her best friends, like her bridge buddies, her cards friends that she hung out with, they were all adoptive parents too. So I wasn't raised in adoption isolation. I knew, you know, like I knew my mom's friends all had adopted kids. But as we got older, like, you know, the problem showed up. Like one of, you know, severe addictions, one ran away and got pregnant. And, you know, that common, like, playing out what happened to their mother that I understand now is a common experience for adoptees. And then there were two people unalive themselves, you know. And when I was in my 20s, you know, my mom was like, well, you're fine, you know, and my brother was struggling with substance abuse. And my mom was like, well, you're fine. And I'm like, yeah, you guys keep telling me that, but I have issues with intimate relationships. And then I see all this dysfunction around me with everybody that I grew up with who's also adopted. And I have to wonder, like, am I lying to myself? Right. And I think that was kind of the beginning, the first glimpse of coming out of the fog. That was before my uncle made the comment to me. And then my uncle saying that was more coming out of the fog. And then, but that was just the painful part of like, okay, my experience of this is different from how people are experiencing me. But then it was actually being in the master's program that I started, you know, reading the books and doing the deep dive and realizing that the counseling that I was doing wasn't even touching my adoption issues. They didn't know. So I had to create my own healing process around adoption for myself because I just didn't know of anybody that was trained that could help me. I think that's part of what just kind of gravitated me into this field and towards this kind of work.
I appreciate all that you share. Yeah, I can relate to that. Like I'm just sitting with the idea of my experience being so different from how others were experiencing me. Yeah. So powerful. That kind of takes me into my next question, which has to do with, you know, the tools, you know, that you've learned along the way. You've shared quite a bit about how your adoptee consciousness evolved and how you have just made choice after choice to help yourself and to help others in the community. And I know one of those tools for growth, right, is the Enneagram.
Right.
And I am like, I just get so excited when I think of the Enneagram. I don't know why that is. Something just goes through me because I've learned so much, but it's not clearly all there is to learn. But I know that you have been involved in learning this tool. So let's talk about it. I know I'm a 5. I've shared that with you and you identify as a 7. So whatever you want to say about the Enneagram.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll just say the first time I discovered personality tests, which Myers-Briggs was the first one, it was such a relief because I felt my temperament so different from my parents and my sisters, who's their biological child. And I always felt like I was made to feel wrong, you know, like you know, like there was something wrong with me because I didn't have enough anxiety about the things they worried about or whatever it was, just, or I wasn't, you know, I have ADHD. I didn't know it at the time, but like not organized and all these different things, and understanding that I was an extroverted, intuitive, feeling perceiver versus my mom being an introverted, sensing, feeling judger. We process the world differently. That helped me understand myself in the beginning. That was one tool that was great. But then was introduced to the Enneagram, and it was in my master's program at Merrill Hurst University. That takes it a whole nother layer. It's not just about understanding the way you process information, but it was this whole spiritual level that your gift, the thing that is your gift, can also become your curse. And that everybody who has a gift also has a struggle. And that also helped me have so much more compassion for myself and then for other people, like looking at, okay, this person that I love does this thing, and then they do this other thing that drives me crazy and I don't understand why. And then getting the Enneagram is kind of this map of going, oh, if I like that trait, it's probably going to come with this trait. And the fact that I have this means it's part of why I struggle with this. At first, I thought I was a 2. When I took the online test, I would tie for 2, 9, and 7, which are all positive outlook types, which isn't surprising as someone who tried to reframe everything to the positive to deal with painful feelings that I would try and avoid. I had a really good Enneagram mentor who kind of explained to me how a lot of women misidentify as 2s, especially if they were raised in religious households, because we're trained to behave like a 2. And then as we kind of explored more and I looked at the way, like how I actually disintegrate when I'm under stress, what the negative behaviors that come out, that was where I figured out what type I was. I was definitely more devolved the way a 7 devolves, not the way a 2 devolves. And noticing that I was pain avoidant, which also led me to want to deepen my understanding of adoption. That was all happening at the same time. I think my attitude up until then was like, why think about anything negative? And then when I started understanding, oh, that's the coping style of the 7. Our gift is joy. We move towards pleasure, away from pain. We can be extremely pain avoidant. But then that ends up causing pain in the long run. Like, you know, we can struggle with substance abuse or just the different things that come up when you just avoid doing things you need to do just because they're painful, right? So that appealed to me. It was like, oh, so if I avoid these things, I'm going to be in more pain. That's where I'm kind of ratting myself out. Like a 1 might be drawn to the Enneagram. You know, 1's gift is goodness and being ethical. And so they may want to be even better. So they might use the Enneagram to try and become a better person, which might backfire, might reinforce their oneness. But if it's done in a way that is really mindful, which is what I love about the spiritual aspect, that's what they do. Well, in my surface, I was drawn to the Enneagram because I was like, oh, well, I do want to avoid pain. So if facing my pain is going to help me avoid more pain, then that's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to face my pain. And I was willing to dive full in and start looking at it. Yeah. And I do think that's made a world of difference in my life. I started noticing, when you asked what kind of tools, I think I would use spirituality in a spiritual bypassing kind of way, you know, like, oh, you know, we're all the same and it doesn't matter, and kind of disassociating from the things that are happening in the physical world that are hard. And so the Enneagram actually became a tool for me to get more grounded and to pay attention, I guess, for lack of a better word, to how I was experiencing things. 7s, when they're under stress, they go to the low side of 1, and we can be judgmental. Like, you know, why is that person bringing me down? Why is that person, you know, being so negative or whatever? So it's something that we don't want to feel in that moment. Using the Enneagram as a tool to understand other people has helped me become far more compassionate as a 7, which 7s aren't necessarily known for.
That's the piece that really did it for me, to be able to identify the people around me that I was interacting with on a pretty regular basis, what they needed from me or how they needed me to show up so that they could be their best self. And I'm thinking of my son who identifies with an 8. I'm thinking of a partner who identifies as a 1. And I tell you, it was transformational when I learned.
Right?
Yeah, when I learned what 1s do and what 8s do, 1s in particular having this horrific inner critic. And it all made sense, like when I started to think about different things, because I don't beat myself up like that, right? And so, it was helpful to improve all my relationships.
Yeah, for me, as I went through the healing process and started looking at my pain, that threw me into a lot of stress. And 7s under stress will go to the low side of 1. And boy, did my inner critic start showing up too. So 1s and I share a stress point, right? So 1s go to 7 when they're relaxed and 7s go to the low side of 1 when they're stressed. So my mom's a 1 and I'm married to a 1.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But I don't think I would be married to a 1 had I not understood the Enneagram. Because growing up with my mom as a 1, she was so perplexing to me. And I didn't understand the fear and the critic and all that. And that her being critical was a way of showing love.
Right.
Because she wanted to help me, right? It was just like, oh my God, get me away from this. And anybody that showed any kind of one-ish energy, I was like, see ya later. Like, no, I don't want that. But then as I grew, I got to appreciate the high side of 1, which is they're ethical. They're reliable. They have this huge sense of integrity.
They do.
Like, they're amazing partners. And my husband, like, I know if there's ever anything that he's doing that is bothering me or I'm not appreciating, I'm very careful about the way that I word it. Like I express my truth, but I do it in this way that I'm trying to be very sensitive to the fact that I know he's going to hear a lot of judgment and that's not what I want him to hear. I just want him to, hey, there's this thing and let's work on it.
Exactly. What I find so compelling about the Enneagram, it's a tool for us and for those that we love. It's like, it's both.
Right.
Yeah.
When I shared it with my husband, he read a very small book. I think it's a small handout kind of book for beginners. And I had him read it. I think it's called The Essential Enneagram. That's it. He came up to me afterward. He's like, oh my God, every annoying behavior in humankind is outlined in that book. It just the way he processed it was funny to me because I read it as like, oh, this explains so much. I feel less confused. And he read it and he was like, ah, all the imperfections in the world are in one book and I'm hating it.
That is funny. Well, you know, for me to learn that I identify with the 5 was very freeing too. We were talking before now. I gave you a scenario. I said, if you were a stranger overhearing 2 people ask where the Starbucks was and you knew where it was, you would immediately tell them, right? And I said that I wouldn't say anything as a 5 because I would think, let me stay out of their business, even if I knew where the Starbucks was. But I loved how you said, not only would I tell them where it was, I might join them.
Yeah, I might walk them over there. You're like, oh, coffee sounds good. Let's go.
And see, knowing these things, right, about ourselves, like now it was like, now I can make sense of why I'm wired the way I am. Because too many times over the years, people have said, I didn't know such and such about you. Why didn't you tell me that? And I was thinking, because you didn't ask, right? And when I read more about how 5s kind of move in the world, I was like, that makes sense now why I would respond that way. Because I wasn't trying to be mean. I wasn't trying to be, as I've later learned, like hoard information. I wasn't seeing myself that way. But in fact, these things help us to better understand why we're kind of showing up in the world the way we are and give us an opportunity to get in balance. Because since I've learned some of the, I guess, more challenging things for me, like being spontaneous, now I can be intentional about that. Like I can give that my attention. In an effort to live a holistic life. I totally want to continue to learn more about the Enneagram and how it can help me and those that I love. So thank you for sharing a part of your experience with that tool for growth.
Yeah, I want to add one thing too. The thing that I appreciate is, to much like no adoption's the same, you know, no person's the same. It's just their books, so their ideas, but somebody's not going to fit exactly. But like what you just said, where you said, I can be more spontaneous. For me, it was the medicine is the opposite, right? Like I had to learn, maybe instead of going, oh, coffee sounds good, I'll walk with you and have a cup of coffee, I should think about my calendar and what I have to do that day. Like, you know, maybe I shouldn't just drop everything for whatever shiny new object shows up right in front of me.
Right. You know? Yeah.
So, it's definitely, I mean, seven's kind of the ADHD type, right? It's a little bit, they're scattered. I can appreciate that I have that nature that wants to be fun, loving, and spontaneous, but also see how too much of that actually gets in the way of actual freedom that sevens want. And you gain that freedom by having more structure, which is something that I would tend to avoid.
Yeah.
And I think fives kind of get that. They know how to structure things to maximize their internal freedom and their freedom in the world.
Mm-hmm. For my listeners, I like to spend time on reunions because a lot of people are embarking upon them now as they listen, learning more about it, wondering what they should do next. Yeah, I'm always interested in a guest sharing about their reunion. And I know you were unable to get your original birth certificate, I'm imagining, through the state of California. And yet you were able to reunite with your biological mother. So you want to share a little bit about how that unfolded for you?
Sure, yeah. So the first time I was going to search for my mother, I was still living in California, and I was about 25, 26, and I called LA County Adoptions, and they, you know, it's closed, but they gave me a list of people who did searches and or different places that could help me search. And I already had my unidentifying information that had been in my file since I was a kid. And my mother knew my birth last name, I guess because there was a medication or something. So I knew that my birth mother's last name was Floyd and that she was from Texas. Unfortunately, Floyd in Texas is like Smith anywhere in the US. It's like one of the most common names. So I kind of knew that she was probably 19 when I was conceived and 20 when I was born because there was a conflict in her age and the paperwork. They searched so many baby girls the year that she was born named Floyd, trying to narrow it down. Well, during that narrowing down period, I started having nightmares. And I realized that part of my coping mechanism with being adopted and dealing with what, you know, the family dysfunction, whatever family dysfunction we all have, was that I had created an imaginary birth mother in my head and structured my personality around this imaginary person. And the nightmares were like, what if that psychological structure comes crumbling down? Like in one dream, she had a great life and I had all these siblings and everything was idyllic and perfect and I missed out. And then in the other dream, she had a terrible life and she was struggled with substances and had all those problems and she actually killed herself in the dream and I was devastated in that. And obviously she was too. And so I realized I wasn't ready to search because I wasn't ready. I realized I needed to explore like my psyche around how I develop myself with this imaginary person in my head. Fast forward to the program that I'm into the year 2000, and I'm unpacking and I'm reading stories on adoption and I'm starting to do that work. And I decide that I want to search again. And this time, I think the difference was that the internet had taken off by this point in time. I pulled out the same piece of paper that I had in the 90s, mid-90s, first person I called, she's like, yeah, if you send me $250, I'll start the search. And then if I find them, you can send me another $250 and I give you the information. So I was like, okay, give her the $250. And within a day, she was like, I found not only your birth mother, but your birth father. Can you want to send me a check? Mm. And I did not expect it to happen that fast. But the way I thought about it in my brain was spiritualizing the ideas, like, but actually it was probably the internet. But I'm like, well, I wasn't ready before and now I'm ready. I get the information, but making that first call was so anxiety provoking. And my adoptive mom, my mom, asked if I wanted her to call for me. And I said yes. And to me, that was kind of a beautiful way to include her. And if my birth mother was going to reject me, there's no other person I would want to tell me than my mom. So she called, and apparently my birth mother was happy for the call, but was freaking out. And she's like, I just need like 20 minutes to pull myself together and then I'll call Jenny. So she called me and we talked for hours. And she said that she had had papers in her drawers for like 10 years to find me, but didn't feel like she had a right to. So she had never fully filled them out. I think her brother-in-law may have put her on a registry because he knew she was searching for me. And that's probably how the searcher found her. So anyway, we talked and then we decided pretty quickly that I would fly out to meet her. I wouldn't recommend this for everyone, but I booked a flight to go to Texas and stayed 10 days with her, with these people I've never met before.
Oh my goodness. What was that like?
I had a panic attack in the airport for the first time. I've never had a panic attack before. I realized that's what it was looking back, just sweaty palms and like, what? And, you know, and I'm ordering a Bloody Mary at 10 in the morning, which is not normal for me. I was just like, ah, freaking out. I also had been struggling with the hives and it was food allergies, stress, whatever, but you know, panic attack and hives. I mean, my body was just like, ah. When I got off the plane, she came up to meet me and instantly I felt relaxed. We were dressed almost exactly the same, like jeans, belt, the t-shirt with the same kind of over shirt with it.
No slide kidding.
On heels. Oh my God. Slide on heels. Our wedding rings looked exactly the same. We had this had the same wedding band. I didn't realize taste was inherited, but it was like, okay, this is definitely my mother. Like, we looked so much alike and just our style and demeanor and everything. Went back to her house and we're sitting out on her porch and it was a little bit chilly. And so I'm like, oh, I'll go get a sweater. She's like, I got a sweater. And we both walk out. We are holding the same sweatshirt.
Talk about mirroring, huh?
Yeah, all the mirroring that I didn't get.
Came all at one fell
swoop. Oh my God, it was so weird. And then we drove to Houston to meet her sisters. Her sisters all knew about me. She has three sisters and a brother. So there were the three sisters and a cousin that came to meet me. And it was like a slumber party at her sister's house. They were all like telling stories. And people used to tease me for overusing my hands when I tell a story. And I grew up in an Italian family. So I really overuse my hands, I guess. So I'm seeing all these women tell stories and their hands are all over the place. And I was like, oh my God, it's my tribe, you know? And I remember like getting up and pretending like I had to go to the bathroom just because I was overwhelmed with emotion and I didn't want to cry in front of Sandy. Sandy's my birth mother, because I didn't want her to feel bad, right? But it was such an overwhelming sense of, I don't know, like, just, I can't even explain what the emotion was, but it was like, these are my people. And I don't know if it was sadness because I had been missing it for so long, or tears of joy because I finally found them.
Maybe both.
It was a lot of mixed feelings.
Yeah.
After that point, you know, we made an effort to fly back and forth. Then after my divorce, I couldn't really afford to fly out there anymore, but she would come visit me every summer and spend like 10 days with me and the kids, and my kids know her as Grandma Sandy. Yeah, it's just, it's been really good. And we're different. We raised in different cultures. She's, you know, more in the conservative Texas culture, and I'm West Coast liberal culture, and that's created some tension, especially in recent years. We're trying to like move pebbles. There's just certain topics we've chosen not to discuss.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, what about your paternal side?
So on my paternal side, I didn't reach out to him right away because I just couldn't take too much at once. So I waited about a year. Then for his story, nobody knew but his wife. And she had been kind of in denial, like, oh, maybe it was somebody else's child kind of thing. So when Sandy called for me, the way my mom called her for me, his wife was really struggling with it. So he was kind, like he sent me a letter with some photos, and then he would call me when she was out of the house. He's like, I think this is important, but she's having a hard time. So I'm basically was talking to me on the sly. That was bringing up like the shame and secrecy wounds that I had worked hard on healing. And I kind of felt like this mistress, you know, that secret mistress. So I wrote him a letter saying that, you know, I didn't really want to disrupt his family and that it was okay. And, you know, I was grateful for the pictures, but that I didn't want to carry on, you know, in this kind of secret way of connecting. And he understood. But during that time, he had asked me if my daughter, who was a toddler at the time, was a towhead blonde, because both his kids were. And I had said, no, she was not. Later, I had my son who was a towhead blonde, and I thought about my birth father and wanted to let him know, but I had lost his contact information. I don't know if that was subconscious or not. And it wasn't until like maybe 10 years later, I decided to look him up on Facebook. He's like, oh, I'm so glad you found me. I lost your contact information. And we talked some more, and he decided to tell his kids, and then his kids talked to his wife, and then she wrote me a very lovely apology letter, which I understood. Like, I had my whole life to deal with understanding my adoption. She needed time to process. Yeah, and then after that, they've been lovely. She's been particularly lovely. She's an artist, and she's drawn me some pieces of art, and they came out to visit me in 2018, and my kids were thrilled to meet them. They're like, oh, we have cool grandparents. They're Austin hippies, you know? Like, yeah. You know, they're like having a beer at 10, you know. my kids really enjoyed meeting them.
And, so you're a perfect example, your story, what you just shared. And thank you so much for letting us in on what happened. That it's sometimes just not yet, right? When reunions take place, sometimes they have to be put on pause. But that doesn't mean that we won't come back around.
Right.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. I feel very fortunate. I know reunion stories aren't always as good as the one that I've had, the two that I've had. Yeah, and I'm grateful that I've gotten to know both of them. And my son looks so much like my birth father when he was young, to the point to where my son saw his high school pictures and was just like, wow, I really do look like Bud, you know.
See, this stuff definitely is intergenerational. There's no getting around it. And as adoptees, it's becoming clear to me that we might have a responsibility to other generations when it comes to search and reunion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The thought of having children is a big part of what motivated me to search the first time. And when I wasn't ready in the 90s, I was, you know, at the point where I was thinking about kids, and I had convinced myself that I was okay with never meeting my birth family. But then when I thought about having kids, I was like, oh, I can't have them not know.
Yeah.
And then I realized, well, if it's a problem for them, it's a problem for me.
Yeah. That's kind of the same way it was for me. My son was like 20. And it just hit me that this is really more about all of us.
Yeah.
You know, and as I would come to learn this story, I know there was great healing on my maternal side, especially with my return, because they knew I was out there and they never could put, you know, a face to this person that my birth mother would talk about. And so, yeah, it's interesting how it tends to be, at least some of the time, bigger than just the adoptee.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I met Sandy in Texas, I realized, I thought it was going to be about my healing, but I realized she suffered greatly. And meeting me was probably even more healing for her. I mean, it was for both of us, but I had never considered the level of grief that she went through.
Right.
There was a tender moment after my daughter was born. She was in the other room and had a couple glasses of wine. She had flown in to visit us to, you know, to see her new grandbaby. I went out to talk with her and she's like, now that you've had a baby, you must just think I'm a horrible person. I said, you know, Sandy, I did think about you when I gave birth and I realized how hard that must have been for you. And then we both just wept.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very kind of intense moment, I think, for both of us. Yeah, no, I don't think she's a horrible person. I think that our society let down mothers at that time. Mm-hmm. She said, if anyone had asked me what I wanted, I would have wanted to keep you, but I didn't feel like I had that right.
Right.
That's sad that society does that to birth mothers.
It is. And I've had plenty of birth mothers say in reunion, that's when they were able to actually let go of the shame, the grief. Their healing was tremendous.
Yeah. I hope, you know, I need to talk to Sandy about that too. We haven't revisited that in a while, but I hope that's true for her.
I hope so too.
Now, you know, that I've been doing more of this work, I'm not for or against adoption. I do think that we need to really focus on family preservation and supporting mothers when they're in crisis so that they can keep their children if they want to. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when there's the rare case that is a very conscious decision and they still decide, then we need to support the ability for openness so that the child still has access to their birth family. And it's not just medical reasons. There's a whole host of reasons that there's that mirroring for identity development. There's the emotional connection and that just comes with seeing your, you know, your tribe, the way I saw my tribe when I was around them and that being able to identify who you are. I mean, I always felt I never had a strong sense of self growing up. And even now, I still feel like I kind of live on the hyphen between, you know, this Fatanich family and the Floyd and the Seitz family. You know, it's like I'm not really a Svetanich and I'm not really part of their family either. And then I think to cope with that, that's where my spiritual being part of humanity comes in. It's like that the unity consciousness of that we're all kind of from the same oneness.
Yeah, that right brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
This has been a lovely conversation, so meaningful and enjoyable. And I think one way to wrap up today would be to talk a little bit about other work you do with feelmorelove.net.
Oh, yeah. So when I went through my divorce, my youngest was 18 months old. He's 18 years old now. I had just graduated from the master's program and I was a mess. Like I didn't feel like I could help other people because I was still unpacking my own trauma. So I threw myself into learning more about child development and parenting and trauma and communication skills. I wanted to help my kids who I knew now were going to experience trauma because of the divorce. And that kind of evolved into parenting coaching and counseling. And I learned nonviolent communication, which has been a powerful tool for communicating empathetically and connecting to kids. And I had a wellness center in Lake Oswego for a while, and that closed during the pandemic, or right before the pandemic, actually. Fortunately, the lease was up. That's when I kind of went back to Adoption Mosaic and started helping them launch as they got more online. So I kind of have both things going on now where I do communication skills and conflict resolution and help people with either just their personal relationships or their parenting with kids with or without adoption, or a lot of times if they're going through a divorce or just the relationships that are, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, non-traditional relationships, right? Like not the two parents household with all the kids, but people that are trying to single parent or parent through divorce or, you know, need parenting advice that is outside of the norm. That's where my focus is with Feel More Love.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to share?
No, I don't. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been nice to kind of reflect on everything and my journey. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it. And I love what you're doing. And I love that you're giving adoptees more voice. And I think our stories need to get out there. And thank you for the work you're doing.
Me too. I think they need to be out there in the world too, so people know the true narrative. So right. Thank you. Thank you for all those kind words.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer.
It is with such ease that Jennifer seems to gift us with what has worked for her. She continues to show up in our community and the world as her best self. I imagine that being a part of Adoption Mosaic is hard work, but rewarding at the same time. When I had the awesome opportunity to co-create with Astrid Castro and her team with We the Experts and Better Together, I knew all the people who make it possible is the reason it is a beautiful and tireless force in the continued momentum of our adoptee movement. Nearly every part of Jennifer's labor of love contains the energy of self-awareness, and that speaks to me. Sort of like putting an oxygen mask on first seems to work best. I appreciate Jennifer sharing her 3-year period of self-reflection. It was during that pause she was able to experiment, listen, and investigate a part of her identity as an adoptee. She then went on to explore the possibility of search and reunion. I marvel at her experience of mirroring with her first mother, which she couldn't predict was as healing for her as it was for the woman who gave her life. The agency she took at the onset of a relationship with her biological father is available to all of us when boundaries need to be set. I'm reminded through their reconnection in later years that sometimes it's not yet, or not right now, that can't be denied in her story. It never surprises me when we can circle back and reconnect for a meaningful relationship going forward. Thank you, Jennifer, for having this conversation with me. I recognize and appreciate the talents you bring to our community. Others do too. I am a believer that if at all possible, moving through conflict into connection is the way. As on your website, Feel More Love in Part states, our ability to show up for others must first be grounded in our own ability to love and care for ourselves. Self-love, self-compassion, and self-care are essential for human happiness. If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit jenniferdianegostin.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. Thank you for being here.